This is the interview of Lawrence Carter on July 28th, 2010 at the offices of the OTS with Chris Seufer, Al Crago, Carl McCartan, Chris Jurgensen, Claire Marine.
Okay, Mr. Carter, my name is Chris Seufer. I'm with the Financial Crisis Inquiry Commission, as are the other three that you see at the table. Not that guy, though. We were created by a statute in May of last year called the Fraud Enforcement and Recovery Act. It tells us to figure out the causes of the financial crisis, tells us to look at various areas, tells us to look at institutions that failed or would have failed but for the receipt of government assistance, tells us to look at the role of non-traditional mortgage lending, tells us to look at the role of securitization, tells us to look at the role of regulation. Those are some of the reasons why we're looking at Countrywide, and those are some of the reasons why we're looking at the OTS, and some of the reasons why we've asked to talk to you since you were involved in the regulation of Countrywide. So that's primarily what I want to ask you about, if not exclusively what I want to ask you about. But before we get to the gist of your involvement with Countrywide when you're with the OTS, could you first, just so we have it on the record, give me your educational and work background since college?
Okay, so I have a two-year degree in business from Northern Virginia Community College. Well, I don't have to remember the date. It's going to be... can't remember the year offhand. I have a bachelor's, a BS in economics from UC Riverside, 1984, I think. I got an MBA from Cal State LA, 1987. I've worked at the OTS since August of 1987. Started out as a financial analyst. Went into the field as an examiner in 1989. And I've had responsibilities as an examiner up until today.
Okay. And have you always been in the West Region?
Always in the West Region.
And always out of Southern California?
Always out of Southern California. Okay.
Tell me, during Countrywide days, which I assume starts no earlier than the summer of 06, when we understand Countrywide at least approaches the OTS about a possibility of flipping charters. Tell me who you're reporting to in that 06, 07, 08 time frame, please.
At one point I was reporting to Daryl Doko, and I don't remember when it changed, but it changed to where I reported to Assistant Director Steve Gregovich. And my involvement in Countrywide was probably more like early 2007. I wasn't really involved in a lot of the preliminary discussions, just a couple of the preliminary meetings, I think, but not much involvement in the last half of 2006.
Okay, so let me ask you about that. Maybe we can make short shrift of that. Did you have any involvement in the approval of the application to obtain a thrift charter by Countrywide?
No.
Okay.
So, not that I can recall.
Okay. We've heard that, I can tell you the application was made in December and the OTS approved it in March of 07. And we've heard from others, and presumably we'll see documents on this, that the OTS was doing some due diligence, talking to the OCC, looking at documents, looking at OCC exam reports, et cetera. Does that jog any memory bells about whether you were involved in any of that process?
Yeah, so I think I was in there probably in January of 2007. I was there a little bit before the charter conversion. I may have given information to the application process that I didn't see anything that that there was any reason to deny it. But my memory is you've got the institution that's been regulated by the OCC and the Fed. The chance of us not approving an application would have been relatively slim, I would think, unless it was a trouble the institution at that point in time. So I was looking at Countrywide, and I was looking at the outstanding items and things that the OCC and the Fed had, or to see if there was any reason why we would object, probably.
Who was, were you like at the institution looking at stuff, or just within the OTS getting information from the OCC, or what? Explain to me how that happened.
I was at the institution, I believe. And I'd have to go back and really look through my notes to see if I was there full time, but at least I was there a good amount of time, I think January, March. When the conversion was in March.
The approval order was in March. The application was in December of 06.
Right. So I guess because we started our first exam April 2nd of 2007.
Right.
So I was there doing preliminary work, mostly talking to the OCC and the Fed. I remember going to a few meetings with them, with management, trying to get an idea of what was going on, what the issues were, whether there was really any reason we would deny the application.
Who was
I
with?
I remember, right?
Go ahead.
Who was with me?
Yes.
Yeah, as I remember, the only real issue that was you know, was a sticky one at that point might have been the fair, you know, there's some fair lending issues, and there was something going on with New York State around. Something to have to do with either fair lending or predatory lending or something like that, as I recall. I don't remember there being any other really major issues that we had to deal with.
Do you recall whether or not, well, actually, let me go back to the last question. Who else was there with you on site, if anyone?
Okay. So, as I remember, I was there by myself, starting off, and then eventually Zalka Hansley joined me as what we would call the assistant in charge and do all the, take care of the operational part of the exam. And then Walt Santos, I think, came even later. And I could have this backwards, but Walt Santos eventually joined me as the asset quality manager, what we call the portfolio manager.
So just the three of you in that staggered time frame before the April exam starts?
Yeah, I'm not sure the two of them joined. I'm not sure exactly when they joined me. And then the fourth would have been, well, the two other people involved, Matt Reisbeck, would have been the compliance lead. I don't remember when he joined. And then Donna Cho would have been the information technology lead, and I don't remember when she joined me.
Okay, and I take it Reisbeck and Cho reported to Edwin Chow?
Well, Cho reported to, there was somebody in between her and Edwin. I think Paley Pang was her boss at that point, but I think that IT reported up. And it's hard to remember because we've had so many changes since then in terms of structure.
Okay, so when you're down that, regardless of who's there on the due diligence review, pre-order, approving the charter application, what are you looking at?
I think mostly I was looking at OCC findings. I know I got a hold of the OCC risk assessment, and I think I got the Fed's risk assessment. I looked through those. I asked them questions about what was going on. I may have looked at some of their findings memos that they were doing with management at the time. I would have talked to. I would have looked at management reports. Anything that I would have been able to get my hands on, but mostly leveraging off the OCC and the Federal Reserve.
Do you recall whether or not you looked at the company's, the composition of their assets, and particularly the loan portfolio?
Sure, I would have looked at that.
Okay. I mean, you know, now we can look back anyway. You know, but what we've seen from, I think, primarily public documents is that, you know, Countrywide was a fairly large originator of, you know, the quote-unquote non-traditional mortgage product, whether it was loans where the borrowers had FICO scores less than 660 or 620, or the Alt-A loans, or the payment option ARMs, or the interest only, et cetera, et cetera. Go ahead.
Yeah, so we knew Countrywide was an option ARM lender. There's no doubt about that. We knew that the bank had been fairly well insulated, supposedly for the better quality option ARM loans. I mean, the bank had its own filters as to what it would take into its own portfolio, which was more protective than what the holding company would originate. The holding company originated for sale, and the holding company had a subprime operation also that they originated for sale or for securitization, and the bank did not participate in the subprime part. That's what we knew.
Were there different underwriting standards, do you know, between the holding company originate for sale and the bank originate for portfolio?
Yes. It was pretty convoluted. I mean, the bank had filters as to what it would accept. So I don't remember whether there were specific loan programs that were originated specifically for the bank at the holding company level, or whether the bank just had filters and took certain loans. But they had standards around, I think, FICO scores, and they had around a lot of things that made them less risky. Presumably, they were supposed to be less risky.
Okay. And just in terms of timing, is this something that you knew about when you were looking at the, before the order approving the charter application gets approved, or is this something you learned through the exams in April 07 and beyond?
Well, without going back and looking, I mean, I can't know for sure, but I would bet I knew that before the approval.
Okay.
I would imagine that would have been in the OCC's risk assessment.
Right. Okay. Now, you know, another thing we've seen is when you get to the end of 06, actually throughout 06, but certainly more so by the end of 06, one, the rate of growth in home price appreciation had declined significantly. It wasn't negative, but the rate of increase had declined substantially. And the level of subprime loan delinquencies were increasing. So I'm wondering if, given the knowledge of the composition of the book, even with the filters, and those two facts, you know, the home price appreciation and subprime delinquencies, whether that jogs any memory bells about any concerns that you would have had or discussed with the OCC or discussed internally with other folks at the OTS?
You know, I don't remember there being any major concerns at the time. I mean, the holding company was originating for sale, and the subprime was originated for sale too. And there may have been, so the delinquencies would have been in their servicing portfolio. And I don't remember specifically if we noticed significant increasing delinquencies in the servicing portfolio or not, but. You know, as I'm sure it's well known now from all the studies elsewhere, you know, if a bank is originating for sale and there's limited or no recourse back to the bank after they sold the loans, we looked at that whole operation a whole lot differently than we did for what you put in your portfolio. And so all the stuff at the holding company was done for securitization and sale, and I believe without recourse. So while there may have been early increases in delinquencies in the holding company's servicing portfolio, it was not a major concern at the time. We certainly couldn't forecast the future. And the bank's portfolio, I don't remember noticing anything that was particularly troublesome at that point.
Okay.
And the bank had no subprime.
Right. I mean, the loans sold for sale. The loans sold, you know, the servicing portfolio that you talked about, where it was your understanding they were non-recourse?
Yeah, as I recall, they were non-recourse unless they did securitizations where they retained subordinated structures, and, you know, that may have been possible. That would have been a form of recourse. Mm-hmm. And they would have to value those and do all those things. And I don't remember the Federal Reserve having any, you know, any real issues with, you know, with that operation.
Okay. And you know, just sort of thinking out loud, I mean, all of those transactions tend to have the reps and warranties, but those didn't impact the sale treatment, right?
Not at that time, no.
Well, do they now?
Well, I think of the FAS 166 and 167, which has an impact on making banks bring just about everything back on their books that they securitize, but that's just a change in account.
Okay. So, do you recall any discussions within the OTS about people being against approval of the charter?
No. I mean, there may have been some, but I don't remember. I remember that we wanted to make very sure that Countrywide didn't think they were trading a tough regulator for an easier regulator. There was a lot of discussion around that. We wanted to make sure that they were clear on that. We understood that they wanted to have one regulator for both the bank and the holding company. They didn't like getting conflicting answers on similar situations from two different regulators, and there were some reasons. Those were supposedly the reasons they were coming to the OTS for a charter. We did not want them to think that we were going to be any easier of a regulator than the OCC, the Federal Reserve. We wanted to make sure the fair lending issues or any other significant issues were dealt with. And there was a lot around that at the time of the charter conversion.
Why was there a discussion about making sure Countrywide didn't think it was trading in a tough regulator or regulators for an easier regulator?
Because I think there were probably rumors and maybe even articles at the time of that. I don't remember precisely.
We've heard from others that the OTS had an outreach program that was instituted by Director Rich to make the benefits of the thrift charter known. Are you familiar with those outreach programs, whether that's the term you know it by or otherwise?
Yes.
Okay, and what's your...
I did participate in. Huh?
And what's your understanding of the outreach program?
Well, you know, I know that we were... And I don't know much about the outreach program specifically. I know that we were an agency that had significant staff cuts under, you know, prior director, had a lot of morale issues, saw ourselves as a dying agency. I mean, at least some did. And I think Director Rich tried to reinvigorate the agency, and I think he did some things to promote the charter. And you know, in his view, I think he was... trying to let those in the industry know what the value of the thrift charter was. That's not all I know.
So, who was the director before Mr. Rich, do you recall?
I think it was Director Gillard.
Dillard?
James Gillard.
Oh, Gillard, that's of course.
Yeah.
Okay, so, I mean, you mentioned that, you know, the staff had been reduced under Gillard. You know, there was a feeling that it was a dying agency, and that was some of the reasons for the outreach program. So, I mean, was it simply to raise money so that the OTS could hire more examiners, and was that the reason?
I don't remember, and it would be for that specific reason. I'm not sure what the reason from my standpoint, he was invigorating, you know, reinvigorating the agency and the morale.
Were you involved in any of the outreach programs?
No.
Do you know any? I mean, was there like literature that got sent out to folks? Have you seen anything? You know, is there a nice glossy pamphlet that says, here's the benefits of the thrift charter?
I think that there were, you know, conventions and stuff like that where maybe OTS had a booth, and, you know, I had heard about that. I was never asked to be at a booth or anything like that. But other than that, I don't know much.
Okay. When you. Did anybody at Countrywide, or strike that, did you ever hear from anybody at Countrywide, the OCC, the Fed, or within the OTS, that Countrywide was seeking the thrift charter because it thought the OTS was an easier regulator?
Not from the OCC or the Fed on site, and not from anybody at Countrywide.
There seems to be an implication there that you heard it from somebody else.
Yeah, I don't remember where I heard it from, but I know that that was a concern. It was that they would see us as a weaker, you know, that they wanted to trade us in, trade in for a weaker regulator. I know that was a concern.
And I'm sorry, I just want to follow up on this a little. You may have, I'm just trying to understand the genesis of that concern, and you may not just recall. Sorry?
It may have been newspaper. It may actually have been in newspaper articles. I know that I was aware of it.
Okay, so the OTS approves the charter conversion in March, and as you said, you guys start an exam, I think, like on April 2nd, 2007, right?
Right.
Okay, and is that your next involvement with Countrywide?
Yeah, it was more like ongoing involvement. I mean, I knew along the way the progress of the approval process. And like I said, unless there was any, you know, major issues, I mean, unless it was a troubled bank or unless there was serious troubles, we would not have disapproved the conversion. I mean, it was regulated by the OCC and the Federal Reserve. It was highly rated. I mean, in terms of Campbell's ratings and holding company ratings, there were no issues there. There were really no obvious issues that would have been a reason for us not to do the charter conversion. Mm-hmm. And I knew that all along. So, you know, I'm looking to make sure, you know, there's nothing there that, you know, would cause us to disapprove the application. And at the same time, you know, I'm doing what I can to kind of plan for examination so that it's a smooth transition process.
Okay.
So we pretty much hit the ground running on April 2nd.
Right. So who's on, same people you mentioned before on the exam team starting in April?
Yeah.
Okay. And so I know, so maybe what makes sense to do is to have you just sort of chronologically walk us through the issues that came up. I mean, I guess the good news is we're really only talking a two-year period, and it sounds like primarily a year and a half, maybe even a year period since the acquisition gets announced in January of 2008. But if you can, just sort of generally walk me through, you know, your role with Countrywide, and let me at least throw out some facts we do know that may help as memory bells and sort of signposts on the road. Of course, we know about the April 2nd exam starting. I think another targeted exam starts in July. At the conclusion of that exam, there's the off-site September 28th, 2007 downgrade of the institution. And of course, in August of 2007 was when, you know, the company was unable to roll the commercial paper and the other short-term funding sources, had to draw on the lines, and then B of A invested $2 billion on August 22nd. A third targeted exam is going on at this time frame.
In December of 07, I think you guys sent sort of the roll-up exam report where the companies still rated a composite 3. The September 28th letter was downgrading the company to a composite 3. And then, of course, on January 11th, the B of A acquisition gets announced, and I think in May there's another roll-up report from the OTS on Countrywide. So, you know, we haven't read all the exam reports. We certainly haven't seen all the documents from the OTS, but we do see those dates from, you know, the public documents and from some of the documents the OTS has produced that I'm hoping, you know, may help jog some memory bells on the issues that, that came up while you were the EIC on the exams in 07.
So an incredible amount transpired over those 2 years.
Yes.
An incredible amount of things happened over those 2 years. So I think, you know, probably for background, this was the plan originally. We do what I call the RASP, which is a risk assessment supervisory plan. And that pretty much spells out what our objectives are for the next year. What resources we need, what are our high priorities, what we want to look at over the next year. So I put that together, and I don't remember the date. Now, hopefully it was before the April 2nd start date of the exam, if not shortly thereafter. But anyway, I put together the plan. It leveraged off the OCC's finding, OCC's work and the Federal Reserve's work at the holding company. One thing, and I think Daryl Doko was still involved at this point, one thing that was really critical was, and this was in keeping that we weren't going to be seen as a weaker regulator, is we took every single OCC finding and every single Fed finding, and the Fed had a lot more, I believe, okay, and we moved that into our own tracking system and followed up on each and every one of their findings. So that was through the transition. And so we have this document that spells out what we're going to do, the resources we need, et cetera. And so the idea was to do four, rather than divide them up into field visits of unequal length, we thought it would be easier to just divide the full year into quarters and start, a mini exam each quarter. And then the idea would be at the end of the year, we would roll it all up into one exam. Now, when things went crazy in August, we didn't really, we were focused on making sure we were in control of what was going on at the company, and so we didn't do a quarterly report, or you know, we didn't precisely do a quarterly report every quarter like we had originally planned. So that's why you'll see maybe only a couple of reports and then the roll-up. All the resources were on keeping a handle of what was going on at the company. We had Federal Reserve people there at the time. We had FDIC people there at the time. I was asked to try to coordinate with state people that were there at the time. Everybody coming in and trying to get an understanding of what was happening to Countrywide and what was going to happen to Countrywide. So there's an incredible amount of activity in that August. August and later 2007 timeframe. So anyway, up until August, we're going along with our risk assessment, what's in our risk assessment plan, and we're doing the targeted reviews that we had planned to do. And I don't remember precisely what those were, but you know, we would look at specific slices of areas, and then we would write exception memos, and we could give the exception memos to management, we would get responses to the exception memos, and that's the way we would ordinarily do the exam. And then, you know, then in August, you have the liquidity issues at the holding company. And that grew into daily meetings to see what the liquidity situation was. This is when I believe the Federal Reserve wanted to come back on site, the FDIC wanted to come back on site, and basically there was just a triage there of making sure we were in control of what was happening. And I think Countrywide was the first where this kind of thing had happened. So you know, we were kind of planning as we went, and so So the immediate thing was to make sure we understood the liquidity situation at the holding company and the bank. So we had daily meetings, daily reports, constantly getting updated on what was going on in terms of liquidity. That was number one. We had contingency plans, had them doing contingency plans, telling us what if, especially at the bank level, because the bank held a lot of escrow funds. We were looking at agreements to see what were triggers and agreements in terms of ratings, downgrades, what would happen in terms of some of their funding sources. And we were looking at all of those things to get our arms around liquidity, and this was in August. And then they had a mini run on the bank in August. And so we were getting probably two or three times a day, getting updated, you know, what's your activity, what kind of customer activity you're having, what are your plans, what's your crisis management, all of those kinds of things, you know, from a common sense standpoint, you would want to do to make sure that they were not going to have just a complete catastrophe. So this is in the August time frame. And I think this went on, I mean, after the mini bank run, this went on and off through the end of the year, and probably even after after BMA announced. That's kind of a separate segment, I guess. So we got the liquidity issue. The original plan from day one was always to move more of the holding company activity into the bank in a controlled way through time. What they asked in August, and I believe it was in August, they asked is, can they accelerate that because they have the liquidity pressures at the holding company? And the bank had the access to the FHLB advances. So the holding company, at the time they had the liquidity crisis and their funding started to dry up, the holding company had a huge pipeline of loans that needed to get funded, and the funding source for those loans was gone overnight. So they came and had discussions with us about, you know, can we accelerate the bank bailing out this pipeline and preventing a catastrophe. And there were a lot of discussions around that. There was a lot of data exchange. We wanted to make sure that the bank was still protected in terms of what loans they ended up with. We wanted to make sure that there was capital maintained at the bank. We wanted to make sure that the bank's board was acting independently and making decisions. A lot of discussions around protecting the bank. And it was a difficult decision because we had to either decide, you know, the heck with the holding company, cut yourself, you know, go figure out how to fund yourself. We're just going to protect the bank, right? Or allowing some kind of controlled use of the FHLB funding source to wind down this pipeline and have some order in, you know, through the whole process. Had we decided to just cut everything off, they were so intertwined, it would have probably been a catastrophe. And so we spent most of our time, I mean, early on, it was all about liquidity. Then we kind of moved to what assets were going to come onto the bank's books. We looked very closely at changes in underwriting. I mean, the holding company clamped down on underwriting. There were times we had discussions where the holding company, because they were balancing, as any company would do, continuing to participate in the market, right, and keeping production out there and keeping your face out there versus clamping down and protecting yourself. And at that point in time, Countrywide couldn't predict what was going to happen. They couldn't predict, none of us could predict that the non-agency securitization market was doomed for the next two to today, right? They were looking at time frames of 3 to 6 months, you know, before this crisis eased. And, you know, that was their best guess, and we were looking at protection over that amount of time. We said, you've got to wind down the pipeline. We were arguing over, well, we want to maintain our pipeline at this size. And we said, well, you know, why don't we were pushing more towards maybe you just need to shut it off. We started talking about what portion of your pipeline ought to be agency production. We pushed them much more to do agency saleable production and to get the non-agency stuff, which is the stuff they couldn't fund, get it down in the pipeline and have an orderly process where the bank funded reasonably good assets, right, and had an orderly transition out of this liquidity crisis. And so, like I said, early it was liquidity. Then we moved into looking at the credit and making sure that everything proper was done to make sure the bank was not going to get stuck with all kinds of trash that was going to sink the bank. Mm-hmm. That's what we were focused on during that period. Fortunately, B of A announced on January 11th, I think it was. I don't remember much, but I think I got that date right. And B of A announced that they were going to acquire. So after that, we move into a mode of rumors that they're going to back out, rumors that the holding company is going to go bankrupt, and dealing with that situation. B of A at some point had put in, I guess, $2.5 billion. I forget when they put that in, but they had put some money into the company. Angelo Mozzillo apparently had gone way back with B of A. You know, they've had prior relationships with B of A. Nothing on the ground came to our attention to suggest there was going to be a fallout. Constantly, I mean, we were getting questions from all the way up to the heads of all the agencies. You know, is B of A going to back out? And I mean, of course, management can tell me whatever they want to, but anytime I talk to B of A or I talk to Countrywide, there's no indication that B of A was going to back out. You know, we continue to talk about liquidity. I think there was another maybe potential mini run at one point in time that we had to deal with, nothing like the August run that they had. And then it was more about, were they going to make it to the close with B of A? And I think the FDIC, we went back and forth on having their DRR people come in and would do the deposit downloads and all the stuff to prepare if they had to, you know, if they had to take over the institution. There's a lot of concern around internal fallout around that. Want to make sure there were very tight controls and secrecy around what was going on around that, with very few people knowing what was going on. That's the big stuff that I can recall. We're very focused on making sure that things were as orderly as they could be in a pretty bad situation.
Okay. So let me ask you, let me go back in time now and ask you some follow-up questions. And let's first focus on the time period preceding the August 2007 liquidity problems. So the first couple of field visits that you guys, or at least the first field visit that you guys are doing. You mentioned earlier from day one the plan was to move the activity from the holding company into the bank. Does from day one mean from the day that they flipped the charter to become a thrift charter?
Yeah, I think that there was always a plan to gradually move the holding company activity. And I'm sure there were some parameters around what kind of activities and how those activities would change also as it moved into the bank. But the long term for them was to move all their lending activities into the bank.
Okay. And why did they want to do that?
Well, administratively, I think it's a lot easier. And second, I imagine it was for preemption reasons, too.
Explain that to me.
Well, they get out from under a lot of the state, a lot of the individual state laws they have to deal with, which was another value, I think, in the thrift charter.
So the preemption issue doesn't extend to the holding company, even though the OTS is the holding company regulator?
No, I don't, and I'm not an attorney, but I don't think, offhand, I don't think it did. I think that the preemption is weaker at that level than it is at the bank.
Okay. I am an attorney, and I don't know either. So that's what I thought maybe you might, since you're with the OTS. Okay, and you said just administratively it made sense. I don't understand. Explain that.
Well, you've got all the transactions with affiliates, stuff you've got to deal with between the bank and the holding company. You do have to maintain some duplicate management processes and probably some duplicate systems and all those sort of things. I mean, one simple organization is just less expensive and more efficient. Complex organization and stuff all
over the place. Was another reason for funding? And what I'm getting at is, you know, you talked about how in August, you know, they asked for, can we do this faster? You know, the credit markets are freezing up. We need to push the pipeline into the bank so we can fund it with Federal Home Loan Bank advances or whatever else they were using. And I at least know from the financial press, which I assume is accurate, that what froze up on them in August of 07 was the repos, the commercial paper, and some medium-term notes. So they could go into the bank, pick up the phone and dial for dollars deposit-wise, or pick up the phone to the FHLB and get advances. And I'm just wondering if that was also a motivation to push stuff down into the bank pre-August 2007.
Yeah, I think it probably was. I mean, it's cheaper funding through the bank. And more stable funding, sure.
And was Countrywide actually, you know, transferring the business into the bank from the holding company pre-August 2007?
Yeah, it was. I mean, little bits at a time. I mean, I forget exactly what portions of the funding they were moving. I don't remember whether we were going to ever permit the subprime piece to move into the bank. I mean, that may have been a piece we were going to require them to hold, to keep at the holding company forever. I just don't remember. Mm-hmm. But obviously, I mean, we were focused on making sure that whatever they were moving into the bank was the lower risk stuff at the time.
And talking about this now, do you recall going back even further to when you were looking at Countrywide in connection with the charter application? Did the OTS know that then, that the plan was, if they got the charter approved, to push the holding company business into the bank for administrative reasons, for funding reasons, for whatever the other reason you told me was?
Yeah, I can't say precisely, but I can.
I'm sorry. I just didn't hear you.
I can't say precisely, but I think we were probably aware of that.
Okay, so on September 28th, well, I mean, before I get there, before August 2007, would you recall, if anything, about any concerns that you guys were finding in the targeted field exams? Or were there? If it helps, the ratings were still pretty good, you know, up until, I mean, even in September, even the September 28, 2007 downgrades it from a composite 2 to a composite 3, so that helps recall.
Yeah, I don't remember anything really major. You know, we were focused on making sure that they implemented the non-traditional mortgage guidance. There was a lot of focus on that, but I don't remember. There was nothing significant that I can remember. I mean, there was ongoing stuff with the fair lending and the New York Attorney General and concerns around that, but I don't remember anything else being particularly significant.
Okay. So, again, you have the August events that, of course, made your days nice and unstressful. And then on September 28th, 2007, we've seen the letter that the OTS sends under Mr. Doko's signature saying we're downgrading you from a composite 2 to a composite 3. Were you involved in that downgrade?
Sure.
So explain to me your involvement in that downgrade.
Well, I would have recommended it. I mean, I would have done the exam work to support the downgrade.
Why did you recommend the downgrade?
That was when we downgraded the composite, right? And we downgraded asset quality.
He's got the letter.
And liquidity.
Liquidity. Liquidity. We took asset quality to a 2. Liquidity to a 4. And the composite to a 3. And you know, and it's kind of interesting because real time, when you've got that much going on in the August time frame, the ratings change is almost an afterthought. And you're so focused on liquidity, which is why we were able to take that liquidity ratio to a 4. We were so focused on liquidity, we knew we could take liquidity all the way to a 4 very quickly. Asset quality, you know, we were looking at it. But we weren't ready to take it beyond the 2 at that point in time. We hadn't done enough work. And an important thing on the bank's asset quality is they had pooled insurance on like 70 to 80% of those option arm loans. They actually had insurance on those loans, and that was a big factor in looking at the rating for asset quality.
And the option arms that... I'm sorry, on the option arms that were on Countrywide's balance sheet as opposed to the yes. servicing portfolio? They wouldn't have them on those, right? But did you look at for that credit insurance they had, did you look at counterparty exposures and who they purchased that insurance from?
Yeah.
And do you recall who it was?
At that point at that point in time, I'm not sure that we had done that much work on that. Like I said, we were focused on liquidity. We were focused on the composite rating. We were trying to keep the ratings up with what we were doing. We were, at least in my view, we were doing the right things on the ground and making sure that we were holding them accountable and making sure that what needed to happen real time was happening real time. You know, downgrading the ratings and sending the letters, it's kind of after the fact, so to speak. So we knew we could downgrade liquidity. And I could have downgraded liquidity in the middle of August, probably.
Right.
Okay, you know, if I was super real-time. But I was more focused on making sure we were in all the meetings, that I was coordinating the Fed, the FDIC, the states, and everybody else to make sure real-time that we had a liquidity situation under control rather than spending time, writing a letter, to downgrade the liquidity component. September 12, obviously, I had found some time to be able to do what we would have known several weeks earlier. Asset quality, we knew, to be honest with you, we knew from day one that there was no way with an option arm portfolio and the balance sheet that Countrywide Bank had that we would have asset quality rated a 1. I personally would not have rated asset quality, with option arms, even though we didn't know how bad option arms could turn out to be. Just the nature of the portfolio, I would have never rated asset quality a 1. But I wasn't going to go in there day one and just arbitrarily say it's something less than a 1. We needed more support for composite 3, I think. I don't think we could just go 4 on liquidity and have everything else looking beautiful and go for composite 3. So at that point in time, we knew we could go ahead and take asset quality to a 2 as at least an interim measure, so we did that. Remember what I said earlier, too, is we were very, very focused on liquidity, not as much asset quality at that point in time. And we shifted our gears as they were going to move stuff into the bank. And we started focusing on asset quality. And then you saw the other ratings downgrades happen after that.
Mm-hmm. So who's involved in, you mentioned that you recommended the rating downgrade. Who's involved? I don't remember. It's been too long since I was at the OTS. But explain to me the procedure for how it's determined what the rating will actually be. I mean, were these the ratings that you recommended?
Yeah, I mean, we've had so much discussion, all the way up to the director of the agency. At that point in time, it wasn't like there was any kind of process where I wrote up some memo. I mean, maybe I wrote up a memo, but it wasn't like a drawn-out process. To where it would go through successive levels. I mean, we were all in discussions with each other constantly.
And in terms of the downgrade that gets transmitted on September 28th, not September 12th, do you recall if anybody within the OTS thought the downgrade should have been different? Not as bad? Worse?
There wouldn't have been anybody that would have said not as bad that I can recall. I mean, we had a lot of discussions around ratings. I think, there's more pushback to the exam. There was probably more pushback to the exam team as to whether they should be worse. And asset quality is a good example because we kept saying they have pool insurance. You can't ignore the pool insurance. Now, at some point, I'll tell you what happened with the pool insurance when we get to that. But
I have a feeling I know. What about at this time being the downgrade in September, is the FDIC around? Or are they chiming in on the ratings, or are they involved in the exams at this point?
I think so. I think they were on site from August to as long as I can remember.
Okay, and any disagreement with the FDIC on the September 28th ratings?
Not that I recall.
Okay, since we're here, let's just jump ahead regardless. I mean, we have heard that there were disagreements between the FDIC and the OTS on some ratings of Countrywide. Do you recall that, whether it's September 28th or some other time?
If there would have been I don't recall any specifically, and the fact that I don't recall it means it's more likely it would have been on component ratings and not the composite. I don't recall any major disagreements on the ratings.
Okay. Since you don't recall any major disagreements on the ratings with the FDIC, do you recall any less than major disagreements with the FDIC as it concerned ratings of Countrywide?
You know, I had, and they swapped out EICs pretty frequently through that period. I had lots of discussions around ratings with the FDIC. And, you know, it's possible that they recommended different component ratings. I didn't worry too much about that. I don't remember there being any major, I mean, it's possible we did, but I don't remember there being any major disagreements on the composite rating.
Okay, and I take it that means... Go ahead.
I had lots of discussions with the FDIC, EICs about ratings.
Did you recall who the FDIC, EICs were? Do you remember their names?
Oh, gosh. Well, there was a Steve guy. There was Mark Nolte was one. Steve, I don't remember his last name. Gosh, I ought to remember the first guy who was there in August. Worked very well together. Brent, maybe. Yeah, I just don't remember.
Okay. And again, just to close out the loop, I think I know the answer to this, given your answers, but do you recall any discussions with anybody within the OTS about the FDIC disagreeing with either composite or component ratings that the OTS assigned Countrywide at any time?
You know, I don't specifically remember any major disagreements. I mean, there may have been one or two. I just don't remember.
Okay. So now when you get into August of 07 and Countrywide is having its liquidity crisis, again, just to throw some stuff out there to maybe help in terms of jogging memory bells, they, I believe, on August 15th or 16th, I think the 15th is the date they sort of realize we're not going to be able to roll, and they actually draw $11.5 billion off the backup lines, which is less than a positive signal to the market. And, of course, that's what apparently sparks the mini run you talked about. There's a fairly large decline in the company's stock price, and it, I believe, also results in less than flattering analyst reports out there, you know, by the street. And then, you know, it was just, I think, 6 days later, the 22nd, that B of A puts in the $2 billion. And the reason I throw those dates and signposts out there is because I want to probe a little bit more this Countrywide wanting to accelerate pushing the business into the bank. And specifically, you've talked about before how, you know, look, we had concerns about the types of assets that were going to go from the holding company to the bank, and we didn't want the subprime going there. And what I'm getting at is when the liquidity crisis hits in August of 07 and they can't roll the repos, the commercial paper, and they have to draw on the lines, did the OTS at that point say, you know, we got to choose the lesser of two evils here, and we'll let you throw assets in the bank that otherwise we wouldn't have because you need to get FHLB advances or you need to get broker deposits to fund, you know, these assets that you can't fund with the sources that you used to use.
No, it didn't happen quite like that. It was there was quite a few discussions around that, and what assets could go through the bank, what assets couldn't go through the bank. At one point, we ended up with a make-whole agreement because some assets, I think, there was some confusion around some terminology in terms of the bank's filter. And for a short period of time, there was some confusion where some of us thought that everything that was going to go on the bank's books met that filter. Everything that was going on through the bank's books was going to meet that filter. Whereas in reality, what the intention was is that everything that would go into the bank's portfolio would meet that filter. But you would have some stuff that didn't meet the filter that would go through the bank as held for sale. And I don't think that there was a ton of this, but we ended up discussing having a make-whole agreement. So we made sure that the holding company, for any of those assets that went on the bank's books that didn't get sold in a reasonable time, the holding company had to reimburse the bank for the marks, for the value of those loans. And so and we made absolute sure that the holding company was either given monthly or quarterly payments to the bank for those marks on those loans. This was not a ton of stuff. And you definitely cannot characterize it as the holding company dumping its entire trash pipeline on, you know, onto the bank, because it was nothing like that.
Okay. So I'm a little confused, maybe a lot confused. Because I thought earlier you said that, you know, one, there were somewhat different underwriting standards between holding company assets and bank assets, and that's what led to this filter about what can go in the bank. So explain to me how loans, whether they're held for sale or whether they're held for portfolio, get into the bank. Let me ask you this. Was it just that, did Countrywide, you mentioned confusion, did Countrywide think, look, we can, loans that we originate for sale don't have to meet the filter because they're not going to be on the bank's books for longer than a short period of time?
Yeah, I mean, there was some of that, but at the same time through this whole period, remember, I mean, they significantly clamped down on their underwriting at the holding company. So maybe there was some difference in standards, but the differences were not like they were, you know, pre-August. I mean, the holding company had clamped down. They also continued, you know, they still had some funding vehicles that they could use. And they used those vehicles. They had this Park Monaco facility and, you know, some of these other ones I don't even remember the names of. So the holding company still had some funding vehicles that they could use. It wasn't completely shut off, at least not at first.
Mm-hmm. So, but
you know, I just don't remember all the details. But it wasn't like the whole spigot just opened and everything that the holding company had just came to the bank, no matter what it looked like. I mean, it was definitely nothing like that. And we knew what was going on to the bank's books, and we knew what the underwriting of those loans were.
Okay, but just so I'm clear, in terms of the confusion that you talked about, did Countrywide think it was okay for loans didn't need to meet the filter if they were originate to distribute loans as opposed to originate to hold loans?
Yeah, I think that they thought that the stuff that was going to be for sale was... There was confusion on our part, and not so much my part, because I understood some of this, that, you know, this filter was not a filter for everything coming onto the books of the bank. The filter was designed for the loans that were going to go into the bank's portfolio. And I don't remember enough of the details about how the held-for-sale stuff was handled, when it ran through the bank. It used to be, and I don't even remember the reason, that some of the held-for-sale stuff would go through the bank and then it would go back to the holding company. Oh, I remember now. It was because there was this weird loophole where they could get CRA credit if it touched the books of the bank. Okay, so there was some advantage to having some loans go through the bank and then back to the holding company and then sold into the market. So historically, they had done some of this. Those particular loans, I'm not sure, went through this filter. On the other hand, they weren't doing the subprime and they weren't doing, they were not trash loans going through the bank's books. I don't remember how it was controlled, but it wasn't controlled by the filter. Mm-hmm.
So for those loans that didn't meet the filter but were originated for sale, did Countrywide Bank or Federal Savings Bank or whatever it became when it got the OTS charter, did it get stuck with stuff when the markets froze up?
I think it got stuck with a little.
Okay.
I think it got stuck with a little, and we made the holding company reimburse the bank for the marks on that.
Okay, that was the make whole. That led to the make whole agreement.
Yeah. But this was not. This was not a major. Like I said, floodgates open. Everything that was held for sale at the holding company just got dumped down onto the bank.
So, but did you guys, meaning the OTS, whether you got it from Countrywide or maintained it yourself, reports that would show, what's on the bank's books and what's at the holding company level?
Yeah.
Okay.
We spent a ton of time making sure we understood the credits. And what was where. And it was very complex and very convoluted, but we made sure that we fully understood what was going where. It took an incredible amount of time, but that's the reason why we had a make whole agreement.
Did the OT...
We knew what was...
Go ahead.
We made them divide up what should and shouldn't be where. And again, there wasn't a ton, as I recall, that went on to the bank's books that they had to have a make whole agreement for.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned...
I'm vaguely remembering, okay? Certain things come back. I think they vaguely had some... I vaguely remember they did have some sort of controls over what went through the bank's held for sale, kind of conduit type of thing. Definitely we never permitted some. And I think maybe during the confusion there was a small amount, very small amount of subprime that actually made it onto the bank's books. Again, with the make whole agreements and those things in place. No real just egregious dump the assets onto the bank's books. There was some misunderstandings here, because a lot was going on during this time. There was a couple of misunderstandings, some miscommunication here and there that got worked out, and we understood exactly what loans and how they were underwritten. They were sending us what they called their guideline changes. These are the matrices, these complex matrices of, how loans, what the parameters of loans were. We were constantly getting updates on that so that we were well aware of how tight the underwriting had gotten, exactly what they were doing, and that they were shifting most of their production to agency. And I think what ended up happening is most of the stuff that went through the bank's held for sale was agency stuff. If they got stuck with anything, it would have been some of the non-agency that they didn't have a conduit for. And a very small amount of subprime, very small.
Okay. So you mentioned that they clamped down on their underwriting guidelines. When did that occur?
No, I don't remember. precisely. I know it occurred in August when they started facing the liquidity issues. They couldn't continue. And we had a lot of discussions because, again, early on, they figured that, you know, this was going to be before they had to draw on the lines, as I recall. They figured that this was not going to be a long-lasting problem. So they were balancing how much do we stay in the market, how much do we produce. So we had a lot of discussions about the shift to agency loans and how much they should be producing in terms of the non-agency product. They didn't want to just get completely out of the market because they didn't, you know, nobody knew how long the crisis was going to last. And we kept providing a lot of pushback as to you need to get the non-agency production way, way, way down to almost none. And I think they were up producing agency in the 80, 90 plus percent range at one point. So very little non-agency, and I think the subprime in 2020 also.
Did you ever hear that Countrywide pursued a strategy known as either a matching strategy or a supermarket strategy?
If that means that they were trying to be what every consumer wanted and tailor the loan to the consumer, then I've heard of that strategy.
It meant they would match. It meant they would match any product offered by a competitor.
I never heard it called that, but I know that they would. They were very proud of their technology and their systems, and that they felt that they could provide quite a range of products rather than just a few homogeneous products. Mm-hmm.
Do you ever recall having any? Did you ever have any concerns while you were examining Countrywide that any of their underwriting guidelines and their loan production essentially ran the risk of a race to the bottom, and that what they were originating was too risky given the funding structure and the capital position of the bank?
Well, remember the bank was pretty well protected as to what they would get. So we didn't have issues with the bank. And frankly, you know, we weren't sampling the holding company's loans, at least not at that point in the exam process. There was no indication from the Fed's work or, you know, that there was really a need to jump into sampling what the, you know, what the holding company was originating. And like I said earlier, I mean, if things could be securitized and sold without recourse, that was generally a lower risk to us, as it was to the Fed. Mm-hmm.
Did Countrywide have higher capital requirements than just what the regs required, or did they just have to meet the? I don't know if that was a part of the thrift charter order or anything. If they had to have a higher cushion or anything, do you recall if there was anything like that?
At the bank level?
Yeah.
I don't remember.
Okay.
I don't remember.
Was there a net worth maintenance agreement? Was there a net worth maintenance agreement between the holding company and Countrywide Bank?
I don't think so.
Really? Okay.
I don't think so. I don't think we did. You know, we used to do net worth maintenance agreements years ago, and I think that we stopped doing those. And I don't remember specifically there may have been some kind of informal agreement. We've done a lot more informal agreements over the last few years. And I know that we have them at 7-11 through the board resolution. Or the directive, I don't recall.
Generally, do you know why? I mean, when I was at DOTS, I always remember the holding company had to guarantee compliance with the capital requirements. Just generally, do you understand why that stopped being a requirement?
I don't. But I know that, you know, we just don't have, as I haven't heard of us doing net worth maintenance agreements over the last several years.
Was that another benefit of a thrift charter? We don't require net worth maintenance agreements anymore?
No. I mean, it was a benefit that we looked at capital at a holding company on a case-by-case basis, whereas, you know, you got the Federal Reserve that's got capital requirements. That was a benefit. I don't remember ever hearing. In fact, we have on I just looked at a PowerPoint the other day because I had to clean off my computer, and I was actually looking at the PowerPoint, the benefits of a thrift charter that somebody had in some presentation. And, you know, lack of net worth maintenance agreements was definitely not on that list.
You still have that PowerPoint, or did you just delete it?
I just deleted it. We just got new laptops, so I wiped out everything.
Well, we've asked Chris for it anyway, but I was trying to make his job easy by having you just email it to him. Okay, have you by any, you know, we've taken a look at the SEC complaint. I don't know if you've looked at that against Countrywide, have you?
When you say the, because there haven't been more than, which one is this?
You know, I don't have the date on me, but it's the one... It's the one alleging insider selling against Mozilla and others. But the reason I ask is because they reference a lot of internal documents at the company as early as April of 05, you know, well before you guys get there, well before the OTS becomes the regulator of Countrywide, but and then throughout 06 and 07 that indicate that the company realizes that the non-traditional mortgage loan product they're originating, whether it's for sale or whether it's for the book, is a lot riskier and is going to default a lot more. You know, they're quite stark admissions in a lot of these documents. And all I'm getting at is, when you were at Countrywide, did you ever hear anyone within management, whether it's a Mozilla or anybody else that you're dealing with, you know, or see any email traffic or other documents within the company, you know, saying, we know this stuff's risky, we know that default rates are going to be twice as much as traditional mortgage product, or words to that effect?
If there was one person that would have had more concerns, it would have been John McMurray.
Okay. And I know I've heard that name. I know I've heard that name before. Remind me who he is.
I think he was the chief credit officer.
Chief risk.
Or credit risk officer or something like that. I don't remember the specific title. And he went up to WAMU. And now he's at FHLB Seattle. I know all this because I just talked to him yesterday because I was at a conference he talked at.
Okay. So what did Mr. McMurray, when you said if anybody would have said something like that, it would have been McMurray, what do you recall in terms of discussions with Mr. McMurray?
Well, I don't remember him ever saying the bottom was, you know, was falling out and the sky was falling or anything like that, but he had a more conservative and pessimistic view of the credit. So he was a good person for examiners to talk to. But I don't know anything from like 2005 or anything like that. I know that he was more pessimistic. I guess the way I looked at it is he was the type of guy an examiner wants to have in that position. You know, he's going to have the jaded view, the more conservative view, the, you know, the pushback against management about the type of stuff that they're originating and things like that. That's about as far as it got.
Okay.
Mr. Carter, I had a quick question for you. As the condition of Countrywide deteriorated during the August 07 timeframe, was there ever any discussion in the OTS about taking a formal enforcement action against them? And can you also comment on what type of enforcement action did OTS take against Countrywide Bank or Countrywide Financial Corporation?
Yeah, I don't I don't specifically recall the discussion of a formal enforcement action, but we would have. We had lots of discussions about what to do countrywide in terms of actions, directives, what we were doing on the ground, on site, and you know, all the decisions were made about having a, having an orderly resolution through to the process. Back then, if you were a three rating, we generally did an informal enforcement action, which would have been something like a board resolution or a memorandum, I think, eventually. I don't even know if we were looking at this back then. Now we do memorandums of understanding. I mean, our use of enforcement action has changed over the last several OTS administrations. Now we jump straight to supervisory agreements and, cease and desist orders or whatever. But at the time, if you were a three-rated institution, generally we would be looking at a board resolution or a memorandum of understanding. I think at that point in time, it was mostly board resolutions.
I saw a reference in one of the documents that there was a board resolution, I believe, on September the 24th, and that there was a capital directive on or about August the 16th, 2007, that precluded the bank from upstreaming dividends to the holding company. And we've asked for copies of that. Is that your understanding of the type of informal actions that were taken?
Yeah, I just saw the copies of those documents, so I we found them.
So there, do you know if there was ever any discussion, I'm sorry?
Go ahead.
You know if there was any discussion subsequent to that to go harsher, either by the OTS or the FDIC?
I don't remember specifically, but I have to imagine there was plenty of discussion around how harsh to go. I mean, there were so many discussions about what our actions was going to be with Countrywide. So many discussions with the FDIC examiners, and even, I don't know if the Federal Reserve was involved as much, but there were plenty of discussions of what we were going to do with Countrywide. I'm sure formal enforcement actions came up. I'm sure composite fours probably came up. I'm sure all of those came up in discussions, but in terms of me actually remembering any specific discussions or any major disagreements or anything like that, I just don't remember.
Are you aware of whether there was any enforcement action other than the two that Al mentioned, that the documents that you looked at recently?
No, I don't. Those look right. I don't remember any other enforcement actions. I know that once B of A agreed to acquire them, that took a little bit of pressure off. I mean, a lot of it after that was making sure that they weren't going to back out and get into that July date. And frankly, after August, after those few months in late 2007, things settled down quite a bit. In terms of ratings, I mean, we look at what our ratings like we do at any institution. We look at what the ratings definitions are, and we look at what the rating, we make sure that those ratings definitions tie to the ratings that we give them. And then the enforcement actions are driven more off the ratings and our confidence that management is being cooperative.
Well, wait.
Do you know if the OTS ever considered or actually instituted a formal investigation of any of Countrywide or any Countrywide institution affiliated party?
I don't think so.
Okay. Do you know?
I don't think so.
Okay. Do you know if the OTS made any criminal referrals related to Countrywide?
Countrywide management?
Yeah, I mean, I'm not talking about the teller that, pinches money out of the till, or even...
Appraisers?
Well, yeah, I mean, if it was an in-house appraiser, yes. If it was,
I don't think so.
Okay.
No, I don't think so.
Okay. Okay, did you guys have anything else? Go ahead.
Mr. Carter, you were mentioning that after the August crisis that things kind of subsided a little bit. But when we look at the TFRs for the quarters of June of 2007, September 07, and December 07, we do see a rapid deterioration in the level and trend of non-accrual loans, 30 to 89 day past dues, and also foreclosed assets. So can you tell us what your concerns were regarding asset quality, and in particular the volume of NPAs?
Yeah, I don't, you know, I'd have to go back to my notes to see specifically. I know we downgraded the asset quality rating. I know that, you know, you had a lot more noise with some of the held for sale that was on the bank's books. I'd have to go back and look.
At the December 12, 2007 letter, the OTS report rates management at 2 were fundamentally sound. Was there discussions within OTS as to perhaps downgrading that worse than a 2, given that management was active in ramping up its exposure of non-traditional mortgage products and represented significant risk concentration to capital?
I'm sure that we had discussions around the management rating. You know, up until that point, all the way through, we had pretty good confidence in the bank's management and their cooperation with us. And any risk that they ran up, I mean, if you're talking about bringing holding companies' risk onto the bank's books, I mean, we had discussions about that. I mean, we knew what was coming on that. So it wasn't that management just arbitrarily went out there and just ran all this stuff up without, without consideration.
Did you ever not have pretty good confidence with management?
Generally okay. I mean, it's you get the few that you get on any exam where they're not perfectly transparent, but nothing really out of the ordinary. I mean, just here and there. I think we liked Carlos. That was ended up taking over the bank. He was a pretty upfront good guy. You know, we weren't naive. We knew Countrywide was an aggressive go-getter, you know, selling company. Okay? So we didn't have blinders on to that. And that, you know, that was the company mantra, so to speak. But in terms of how well they managed and their risk management functions, and I mean, they just, their technology was incredible. The amount of data that they did and their reports were very, very good. No, we didn't completely lack confidence in management. We had to push back, like I said, with the pipeline, reducing the pipeline, because they wanted to make sure they continued to produce and had a face in the market. But, that was expected. In terms of lying to us or concealing things, nothing out of the ordinary.
Sure, and I'm not necessarily asking about lying or concealing things. I'm just talking about the business decisions to grow at the rate they did into the product that they did, funded by the funding sources they used, and maintaining the capital levels they used that ultimately proved to be grossly insufficient.
Well, now most of that you're going to have to go ask the OCC and the Fed, because I think most of that growth funding decisions. I think the Fed probably made some comments about diversifying funding and, and the concentration in fundings, but they weren't too terribly concerned. But, all of that run-up in growth in the option ARM product happened before I got there.
Well, I understand that, but then you guys get there, and you get to deal with it, and that's why I ask. And, you mentioned earlier that from the day you went in there, you knew asset quality wasn't a one. You saw the volumes of the non-traditional mortgage product and all of that. You know, so that's what's, I mean, believe me, I take your point about, ask the OCC and the Fed about that. But I'm more, and I will, but I'm more interested from hearing from you, you know, okay, you come in and you see, boy, this company grew like this into this kind of product with these kind of funding sources and with this kind of capital. I know this isn't an asset quality one shop. And sure enough, when the market sees up in the fall of 07, they're in huge trouble because of those decisions. And, you know, that was more of my questions in terms of looking at management and rating management than are they lying to you or keeping stuff from you. I'm just more of it.
Okay, so there's several things to think about. I mean, number one, the non-agency securities market had pretty good depth. Okay, nobody figured that market was going to dry up overnight. Nobody had a concern that market was going to dry up overnight. I didn't have a concern that market was going to dry up overnight. So that's number one. You know, along those same lines, right or wrong, if you can securitize and sell without recourse and without, you know, every state in the country coming down on you and suing you for predatory lending and lots of bad stuff like that, we generally looked at originate for sale different than we looked at for originate for portfolio. But not only that, but the origination for sale was being done at the holding company, which was a step removed from the bank. The bank was protected as best as we could tell by the filters and by the agreements and by the way they dealt with the holding company. And option arm loans have been around for years and years and years and have never been a major issue. Okay? Until they expanded, you know, across the country and they became more of a mainstream product. you know, yes. An adjustable rate mortgage product is more risky than a fixed rate product. Yes, an option ARM product is more risky than your typical adjustable rate product. But nobody ever could have, you know, maybe somebody predicted. I certainly didn't predict that the option ARM product was going to turn out to be what it turned out to be. So, no, I would have rated asset quality a 1. Would I have rated it a 3? Probably not. Just because it is a higher risk and it is a concentration, I'm just the type of guy that's not comfortable with a 1 rating unless you've got nothing but fixed rate loans on your books and no interest rate risk. It's just kind of magical. That's just the type of person I am. I'm certainly not saying that I thought that they had amounts of risk that would require 3 ratings at the time. You know, as things started to turn, obviously we made changes as it went along. Even then, not predicting that, you know, national oil prices were going to fall and that you were going to have the crisis that we had. I mean, nobody saw that coming.
Okay.
Capital levels, you would have considered, and I mean, the other thing you got to remember is that this is still single-family lending. You know, presumably a lot of these people are living in these houses. That's a big presumption. Now we're finding out all kinds of things otherwise. I mean, typically, single-family lending is a low-risk business. And yes, subprime is more risky, and yes, option arm is more risky. Yes, adjustable rate mortgages are more risky. But, you know, I mean, people are still finding out things. I went to a conference over the last 2 or 3 days. All kinds of modelers and statisticians and everything else. People are still finding out things that they would never have predicted 3 years ago.
Anything, Mr. Carter, thank you very much for your time. We appreciate it. We will, I'll tell you what I tell everybody, we'll go back and look at our notes and maybe figure out that we forgot to ask you something. And if so, I'll contact Mr. Sturbins and if I have any follow-up questions. And if I do, I promise you it won't take as long as today did.
Okay.
Thank you for your time.
Thanks, Lawrence Clark.